is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to PakCast, a weekly audio dialogue between Pakistan and the West. We're podcasting from Seattle, Washington, USA on May 1st, 2007. This is Volume 3, Installment 11 of PakCast. I'm Ethan Casey, author of Alive and Well in Pakistan.
And I am Nasser Aziz, producer of PakCast.
And with us, as usual, is Asad Faizi.
Hello.
Asad, we've been, the last two episodes, we've done full-length interviews with the Indian journalist Siddharth Varadarajan and the Pakistani novelist Mohsin Hamid. So we're back to a more usual format this week, and it's been 3 weeks or more since we paid attention to what's going on in Pakistan. What's going on with the judicial crisis?
Well, a lot of things are happening in Pakistan, and I wonder if our listeners now really wonder about us suffering from multiple personality disorders.
Well, there's so much to cover, isn't
exactly there? There's so much to cover and so many things to do. And it's a legal battle now, where they have come up with 132 constitutional points they are objecting to. This whole reference to begin with, what they are saying is that the president had absolutely no power to send a reference to the Chief Justice against the Chief Justice, because the Constitution of Pakistan doesn't allow that. Clearly, they're pointing to a loophole in the Constitution where the President can send a reference against a judge of Supreme Court, but not the Chief Justice itself.
And no, it doesn't necessarily specify that it does not exclude the Chief Justice, but it does not mention the Chief Justice.
So that's the legal point that they're wrangling with. Plus, I think what they're saying is that the whole the president has also what they call initially they said he made the Chief Justice defunct, and now what the government is saying that no, he's on a forced leave of absence. So another point was that the president has absolutely no power to send the Chief Justice on forced leave of absence.
So where is this headed? It'll be a week from now. It'll be May 7th, 8th, 9th when people are listening to this. And then, of course, after that, where will things be by mid-May or beyond?
Yeah, so a lot of legal experts actually have come out, and they have said that this is not going to be something that's going to be decided in a very short period of time. For example, tonight, there is another hearing.
Yeah.
There is a hearing, which is the day of May 2nd in Pakistan. There'll be a hearing in Pakistan. So they're like, at the moment, there are like three or four different hearings are happening in Pakistan related to that. One of them is the Supreme Judicial Council itself, and then there are three or four petitions that are filed against that. The Chief Justice of Pakistan has had tremendous reception given to him in all the major cities in Pakistan, in Karachi, in Peshawar, and now he's next going to Lahore, and he has support all over. So the government has actually come down pretty hard on some of the TV stations. For example, Aaj, which means today, is one of the TV stations in Pakistan. The government has actually issued an advisory and threatened them to shut down if they continue to provide coverage, which is, I think, a horrible thing for them to do. They've tried to do. I think what is happening is that the initially Musharraf and his government, they are now coming to terms of what it really means to have an independent and free media.
And when it comes right down to it, they're not so sure they like it.
Yeah, plus I think
But I think it's a little too late for that right now.
It is the cat out of the bag. Mm. I think what initially they thought was independent media means that you can show as many music shows and dramas and programs, on TV. But now that the media is independent, they've been independent for the last 5 years, they know You know,
how to pull their strings.
What the government is discovering is the distinction between entertainment shows on one hand and actual journalism.
Exactly. And so they're trying to control some of the news media, but I don't think they've been very successful because...
And I don't think they will ever be. So yep. It's just a little too late for that.
We're going to move on to a voicemail that we got from a listener. But first, you had another thing you wanted to raise, Asad.
Well, I was just listening and reading the reviews about
George Tenet's book.
Yeah, George Tenet's book that has come out.
George Tenet, the former director of the CIA.
The slam dunk guy.
That's right, the slam dunk guy. Now, he has a book just out where he seems to be going back on a lot of things he said back when.
Yeah, at the center of the storm. You know, this is amazing. I think that all the bureaucrats in the world, they go through the same school because it's very common in Pakistan also for this military or civil bureaucrats to come out after the fact, and then they publish all the books and they claim how they never liked what was going on. Mm-hmm. But of course, then they never resign from the position and they take full advantage. And now, 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road, they would all come out, of their crawl spaces, and they would write a book, and they would say how horrible things were. And George Tenet is not doing anything different. Nevertheless, as much self-serving, his memoirs are. They still have a lot of value, and so do all other books that I despise the authors, but not the books, because they do document in the end, what.
Well, and anything that
happening.
Helps bring Bush down is good in my book.
Well, not only that. I know we all know where you stand, how much you love Bush, but it's also documenting the facts, right? What was happening at the time, because the governments definitely all over the world are not
so
very.
Did he say anything about Pakistan or?
Actually, so one of the things that one of the things that he said was that U.S. did actually bully Pakistan,
just like what Musharraf said.
Just like that, Musharraf.
What threatened to bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age?
It's interesting. He said Armitage.
Richard
Armitage did bully Pakistan, but he said, I can't believe that Armitage would have said that I would bomb you to Stone Ages, but he did bully Pakistan. That's what he comes out and says.
So Tenet is basically basically supporting the Musharraf's point.
Yeah.
Well, I have to give him, I think he did, in 2001, he gave the warning of Al-Qaeda striking in U.S. and his warning was not heeded. So I think at least that goes.
Yeah, this warning was given to Bush and his administration at Texas Ranch.
Yeah.
And Rice was available there to listen to this warning by the CIA. And right after 9/11, Rice did make some comments like, oh, we never knew about this case in point. You know, like they will ever like fly planes into the buildings. Which was a total lie. It's been proven already. So
yeah, and
so that's
plus I think what he documents that in the aftermath of 9/11, they had their mind pretty much made up. And Josh, to his credit, George, and it does admit that he kept his mouth shut and did not say anything. But
that was part of his job, I guess. So.
I guess that was the kind of people Bush wanted around him. Essentially, that they just wanted a war against Iraq, and they didn't care about the truth. They didn't care about any analysis. They did not care about facts. They just wanted.
They were trying to fabricate the intelligence, basically. Okay.
So we've got a thanks, Asad. Sure. We've got a we've got a voicemail from a listener, Naveed Malik, who's a graduate student at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, has sent us this voicemail.
Assalamu alaikum. My name is Naveed Malik. And I'm a master in public policy candidate at Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. I'd like to first ask a general question, and that is, what role does today's press, Pakistani or otherwise, play in Pakistan's politics and public policy? And is there any particular subsection, that is the English press, print versus broadcast, that's more influential than others within the policy decision-making process? Also, citing your recent series on the necessity of law, how would the reaction of Chief Justice Chaudhry's dismissal been different had the press freedoms that exist today not been in place in Pakistan? Thank you.
He's asking three questions, basically. So what's the influence of print media versus the broadcast media in Pakistan? English versus whatever else, right? And
how would the reaction to the dismissal of Chief Justice Chowdhury have been different if the media had not been as free as it is?
Yeah, which was the case during Nawaz Sharif time, yeah, when they actually attacked Supreme Court.
Ethan, this is your test of your journalistic, you know, professorship.
Well, I might as well go ahead and address that. I guess I was a professor for one semester, yeah. So I was at Beacon House National University in Lahore. As far as I'm concerned, journalism is not journalism unless it's genuinely independent and dangerous and taking chances and speaking truth to power, using, you know, to use the cliched phrase. A lot of what passes for journalism is there to support the state agenda, and that's not necessarily all bad. But we certainly can see the downside of an essentially captive media here in the U.S. I think essentially things like podcast are what media ought to be, which is genuinely independent, genuinely critical. That's certainly what we're aspiring to.
But how does it impact the political structure of the country?
I think a good independent outlet can be influential well beyond its subscriber base. I think, for example, the New York Review of Books, which is really has only about 100,000 subscribers here in the U.S. and worldwide, but when somebody writes something in the New York Review or in Foreign Affairs or in The Guardian, it's listened to.
So you think genuinely that media, independent media, can have influence in policy decisions and policy making in the country?
Absolutely, it can, for reasons of prestige because
the politicians are not as smart as journalists, right?
Well, essentially, yeah. Let's move on to the second.
So the second part of the question was actually different. He wanted to know about different segments of journalism in Pakistan, like Urdu journalism versus English journalism, and mm-hmm. print media versus like electronic media.
Yeah, I think as far as print media in English and Urdu is concerned, I would say English media, print media, is more influential because most of the Pakistani bureaucrats and aristocrats are from, you know, English background.
Now, that said, the English papers have much lower circulation than the Urdu and other vernacular papers.
Yeah,
right?
But English papers do have more influence.
Yeah.
And that tells you about the elitist mm-hmm. community in Pakistan, that who they are and where they come from. And English media has much more influence on Pakistani politics, right? But then again, vis-a-vis the broadcast media, we have most of it is in Urdu. How do you explain that phenomenon?
I kind of have a different view on even Urdu versus English before we come to the broadcast versus print. Mm. I think Urdu media has more influence in bringing mass mobilization.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is any issues, you know, which can really mobilize people to come to the streets, I think Urdu media is closer to the pulse of the nation.
So I guess the question of influence has to do with whether political initiative is coming from the mass, from the bottom up, or
exactly,
from the top down.
Exactly. I can see Nasir's mm-hmm. point that the bureaucrats only read English newspaper probably in Pakistan, but mm-hmm. then when the major political changes come from the grassroots, I think that's where the Urdu media has more influence.
So those are the functions of the two different language media.
And also, yeah. I would like to, I mean, I can ask you probably, Asad, that I haven't read like an Urdu newspaper in a while, but what percentage of Urdu print media is right and left and again English?
So yeah, this is very interesting. Most of the, I would say the majority of the Urdu media in Pakistan is center or right to the center. There is little, of course there is, but there is little left of the center. Whereas most English print media mm-hmm. is center or the left to the center in Pakistan. So that's definitely another divide, English versus Urdu.
And to add the complexity to this, like most of the bureaucrats and aristocrats lean towards
they lean towards whatever US tells them to. So
mostly historically, yeah. right?
yeah, so it's because, yeah, yeah. You're right. I mean, so if they want to, so if the politicians or political establishment want to influence people, they would go to the media. But, you know, if they want to be influenced, they would go to the English media, I would say. Interesting, you know, about the print media versus electronic media, although print media is, Pakistan has a very rich and long history of the print media, you know, like the Pakistan movement 60 years ago, Pakistan came into existence, but the Pakistan movement was more than 100 years old. And there were great names of the journalists were very influential in the whole Pakistan movement through influential journalists through the print media. The electronic media, on the other hand, is very is pretty new. It's only 5 years ago, but I think its influence has really increased.
You're talking about what you mean is the commercial electronic media, Jio and ARY, as opposed to PTV, which has been around for a while, but
which is a state mouthpiece anyway.
Well, yeah. State mouthpieces don't really count as media in my eyes. So
they're propaganda machines,
exactly.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So even the state controlled newspapers didn't have any influence in the past, and there were some. And throughout the history, the struggle of Pakistan, Pakistan movement, there were a few names, Bahadur Yar Jung and Hasan Mohani and Majid Nizami, and they were great names, and they have been very, very influential on Urdu and some English also media. Electronic media, as I was saying, even though they are only 5 years old, but I think their influence is expanding really fast, because Pakistan always had excellent communication network. I think it was one of the best networks in this whole region in Asia.
Right.
And you can see, you know, for example, telephone, television, you know, access to the remotest parts of Pakistan. So you actually, it's kind of interesting that even to the, you know, the ultimate most remote parts of Pakistan, the TV is accessible, and so they listen to the radio and the TV.
Yeah, and in a segue, when I was in Pakistan right after the earthquake in November 2005, when I was there doing some relief work, I was in these remote villages where there's no power, no nothing. They've lost all their houses, but they have cell phones.
Yep. So, you know, and this is and one of the things. Mm-hmm. This is amazing, actually. Pakistan, for some reason, Pakistani politicians are as much screwed up a bunch they are, but for some reason they have been really focusing on communication. I mean, Pakistan was the first country in this whole region that laid the fiber optic network and all that stuff, right?
And so the reason is because most of these politicians come from the feudal families, and most of the feudal families live in the remotest regions.
Well, that could be a reason. I never thought about that, but that's a very good explanation.
Interesting point, Now, the third point about the hypothetical question about what if how would this judicial crisis have played out if the media had not been as free as it is?
I don't think it's quite as hypothetical as you think, because this is the second time in the history of Pakistan that the judicial the state or executive has actually taken on the judiciary. The first was during the Nawaz Sharif period, when in the broad daylight Nawaz Sharif's goons have attacked Supreme Court in Pakistan.
It was like a mafia.
It was like a mafia. And actually what Nawaz
1998 99,
yeah, so what Nawaz did is actually 1998, I think.
98, yes.
What Nawaz did was actually 1,000 times worse than what Musharraf did. And Musharraf, has all he has done is really, if you think about it, if he has filed a reference against the Chief Justice, which is within the constitutional bounds. But then the thing which will really went wrong is how they mistreated the Chief Justice after that.
On television.
On television. And so the thing which really made the difference was the live coverage of TV, on TV. And that's the reason why these politicians got so angry at the media. And you saw the attack on Jio TV station by the police the same day, because they...
And that was all caught on camera, too.
That was all caught on camera. And can you imagine a politician in Pakistan who has been ruling? I mean, these are the same faces. Let's admit it, right? I mean, most of these ministers were also there during Nawaz. They could have never imagined that if they had gone after the judiciary, and they have been going after judiciary for the last 60 years, how dare this media makes it into such a big issue, and they just couldn't handle it.
If the media had been more controlled, this would in some ways not have become a crisis.
This would be a very low priority story. Yeah. This would not even make it to the headlines.
As it happened in 1998. So I think the way I look at it, it's like, you know, it was not possible for the theory of relativity on Einstein to come before Newton, right? So the law of gravitation actually was the fundamental basis on which then the relativity was. So I look at it pretty much the same way. I said, like, the most fundamental is the freedom of information, mm-hmm. and in the media, independence of media, and then on which you can build freedom, independent judiciary, and other states. So I think Musharraf has wittingly or unwittingly, I think he started this revolution. It can only go in one direction.
Sort of like Gorbachev.
Well, that's a whole different.
Was Gorbachev a CIA plan?
I'm not telling. Yeah.
He was definitely a very controversial leader of former Russia.
I've got another one more point to make, which is I think a partial parallel. In 1996, I spent a fair bit of time in Indonesia. I was living in Bangkok at the time and traveling around Southeast Asia. And in 1996, the movement to bring down Suharto, who had been in power at that point for 30 years, essentially as a dictator, the movement was gathering steam to get rid of him. He eventually was forced to resign in 1998, and Indonesia is now freer than it was. But what was interesting to me, precedent was that in 1965-66, there was a transition from Sukarno to Suharto. And that was launched by a coup and the involvement of the Communist Party and a big major political crisis that resulted in, by most estimations, about 500,000 people dying during that period, 65-66. Mm-hmm. That's the Indonesian Malay language is the source of the word amok, as in run amok. So we had this really essentially genocidal situation in the mid-60s. I and many others in 1996 would have predicted and did say it has to be the same way. There's no way you can have a transition from Suharto to whatever's coming next without that kind of massive bloodshed that happened in 65-66. And guess what? That didn't happen. Mm. It was an essentially peaceful transition. And I put that conundrum to a journalist friend of mine in Bangkok, and he said the difference is CNN. Mm-hmm. The world was watching. Mm-hmm. And you may be seeing something similar here in Pakistan as well. Sure. But
definitely the Pakistanis are watching every move that the government is making, and, mm-hmm. and they're under scrutiny right now. And also I will attribute this whole media, especially the electronic media, towards the younger generation Pakistanis who are adopting internet and, you know, all those technologies for their news and gathering and everything else. And so they're playing a big role in blogosphere. Mm-hmm. And I think they're not more dependent on local open free media anyways. But so there's multiple channels for these people to get their news from. And that's changing a lot of landscape in that area too, I think.
Which is absolutely different from the way it was 20 years ago or even 10 or even 5 years ago.
And I think more and more younger Pakistanis are getting educated, majority of them, in the history of Pakistan. Yep. Yeah, so.
Yeah, another thing is that you only through experience with independent media do you learn as a citizen how to get the truth, how to get the facts out of, you know, like the governments are very good at actually creating disinformation, you know, inundating people with all kind of rumors and stuff. But having a free media and a great media, I have to say, in Pakistan, I subscribe to a lot of different Pakistani channels, and I know the quality of Pakistani media today is 10 times better than the kind of junk I watch in American media.
But that's exactly what I was going to say. Like, the American media is free media, but again, it's a corporate media.
Right.
And the corporate is in bed with the government and administrations. So hence,
that is not the case in Pakistan.
That's not the case in Pakistan, yes. But here's the case. So the media in the U.S. is really not the free media that we hope it would be. So we have another side to this whole free media issue, I guess.
Right. And for that, you need to read Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. Mm-hmm.
One other thing we'd like to include in this week's program. In early April, I was invited to a seminar at Harvard University.
What was it about?
It was titled Contested Spaces, Competing Narratives Towards Human Rights and Democracy in Pakistan.
That's a mouthful.
Yeah. It was organized by Bina Sarwar, who's a well-known Pakistani journalist who's currently a Carr Fellow at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, and writing a book about progressive politics in Pakistan. She gathered a bunch of academics and a few journalists like myself and others to a full day at Harvard. And the previous evening, April 6th, was a keynote speech by Professor Aisha Jalal. So during the seminar, in the morning session, a young assistant professor at City University of New York, Sadia Tour, assistant professor of sociology, anthropology, and social work, gave her presentation, and here are a few minutes from that.
In the 70s and early 1980s onwards, the character of NGOs in any particular place in the world changed as they were increasingly drawn into the network of World Bank and its related institutions of the capitalist world system. Development itself was always a problematic project from its very inception, tied as it was to Cold War politics and the foreign policy priorities of the First World. In the late 1970s, as the IMF and World Bank imposed structural adjustment policies in developing countries, they also started to draw more and more community-based and voluntary organizations into their development projects. This accomplished two things. It changed the structure of these organizations such that they became dependent, obviously, on funds. Funds then were tied to projects, which made the work of these organizations subordinate to the funding cycles and funding priorities of donors. This made it extremely difficult to maintain long-term relationships with any particular community and therefore to initiate any meaningful long-term social change. These largely welfare or development-focused organizations also served another function. They enabled the retreat of the state from the social sector, which, after all, was the linchpin of structural adjustment. Structural adjustment was the thin edge of the wedge, which we now understand as neoliberalism, or the unbridled rule of profit over people. After the breakup of the Soviet Union, the World Bank shifted its attention to civil society, a term which progressives in Pakistan have rather uncritically taken up. As a concept, civil society obviously has a long and venerable history within liberal and Marxist political theory, but that was not the sense in which the bank appropriated this term, as in fact it does to any term which it appropriates. And the bank has a history of appropriating critical discourses and concepts such as empowerment and gender and participatory development, and so as to take the sting out of them. In the hands of the World Bank, civil society became synonymous with NGOs, such that they are now routinely called civil society organizations. The discourse of human rights within the World Bank and international NGOs thus came out of the democratization of former communist countries. The fact that INGOs and the World Bank now talk about and fund human rights work is not something to be uncritically celebrated. It indicates the degree to which these discourses have been co-opted by the neoliberal enterprise.
So, Asad, while you're listening to this, you were turning red and blue.
Well, it's not because I'm a patriotic American. I think it's just because I got so angry. You know, this is amazing that you have to be very so screwed up to even look up to World Bank and other organizations to do your volunteer work. I mean, to me, the real volunteers are the ones who, like Adi, who is running the largest ambulance service in the country, who is running hospitals, free hospital, charity hospital, and orphanages. Imran Khan, who has built the free cancer hospital. And, you know, Dr. Shamil, who is an oncologist, who is running a free children cancer hospital in Karachi. And even,
schools like the Citizen Foundation.
Yeah, the Citizen Foundation, who has 300 schools, and they're targeting 1,000 schools in the remotest and most underprivileged areas of Pakistan. Those are the heroes to me.
And these guys are not using the World Bank or IMF.
Absolutely not. They're not using any funding. They don't look up to the West. They don't look up for the charities from the Western government. They don't, tell the world, the West, look at us, how westernized we are. These are the people who are running these charities from within the resources of the Pakistan. They are doing the real work. What really annoys me is to hear about all these theories, how World Bank is putting the money in the wrong areas and how we're not utilizing the money. I mean, for God's sake.
Why even go there, huh?
Why even go there? It's a self-help thing. It's a volunteer organization, right?
So the organizations you admire are the ones who say, do it ourselves.
The indigenous ones, right?
Absolutely. And who are doing the real work, right? I mean, not like, I'm sorry. I mean, I understand, let's take the case of Mukhtar Amai, for example. I mean, what has happened to her was horrible and horrendous. And we all should sympathize with her, but look at, she has been made into a money-making machine by some of these NGOs who have taken her out of Pakistan and into the West, and now they are like, this poor lady who has gone through so much trauma, she can't, I mean, she's not an educated lady. She can't even utter a complete sentence and it's the kind of background she's coming from. And now they're like books come in with her name on it in French and in English, and they have, blogs.
You think she's being used?
Absolutely. I have no doubt in my mind.
I can't speak with authority to that point, but what I'll just say is that Bina Sarwar showed a what I thought was a powerful documentary about Mukhtar Mai at this Harvard conference, and perhaps Bina or some other listener would care to contribute to next week's
There are podcast. Thousands of women in Pakistan who are rotting in jail because they have been wrongfully accused for one reason or another. None of these Western NGOs go and help them out. They're women.
You're saying there are like thousands of Mukhtar Mais. Why this one, right?
And they always are looking for a case, like Mukhtar Mais case, where they can capitalize on it, make it high profile, and get some money from the West, and so that they can. Look like the protector of women rights. They latch on to issues which are totally meaningless to the people in Pakistan, like mixed marathons, like women running a marathon. I mean, do you think the poor people in Pakistan, in the villages who don't have much to eat and clean water, do they really care about running in mixed marathons in the streets of Lahore? Who are they kidding? They are targeting their message towards West so that they can milk some money from them.
I'm just going to add a couple of things, and then I think we'll wrap up this show. The most interesting things I felt Sadia Tour said, her phrase is the NGOization of politics. I think she's getting at something like what you guys are talking about and saying that. She also spoke of the retreat of the state from the social structure. That brought to mind something that the medical doctor Paul Farmer, who does notable and well-noted important public health work in Haiti and Peru and Russia and elsewhere, said to me about the phrase saying, as NGOs, we risk letting the state off the hook. If the NGOs, with funding from the World Bank and wherever, pick up all these public health or education or whatever, and all that money is coming from the West, then it corrupts not only the NGOs, but also the state, and it lets the state retreat from things that the state ought to be doing, like education and public health. That's Farmer's point, and I think that's something that Sadia was getting at as well. Also, what comes to mind is a book that really made an impact on me many years ago called Lords of Poverty by Graham Hancock, who's a British journalist. And Hancock had worked in some of these big international organizations, like I think UNDP or World Bank, or he was involved with them in places like Ethiopia. And his book Lords of Poverty, which was now probably 20 years old, really took these big international organizations to task and said this is a corrupt.
Plus, it's a controlling mechanism too.
I think many people see that. This has been a long show tonight, and we've certainly covered a lot of ground. I really hope that we, especially here in the last few minutes, we've said some provocative things. And so if you've got something to say, say it.
You're going to Chicago to say some more provocative things, aren't you?
I am going. I said some provocative things in Boston. I'm going to say some more provocative things, perhaps Chicago. Different ones in Chicago. Over Memorial Day weekend, the Human Development Foundation has invited me and a number of others to celebrate its 10th anniversary. And if you want to know more about what's going on there, Memorial Day weekend, go to hdf.com, and you'll see you'll get a sense of what's going on. And I'll bring back a report from that meeting afterwards.
I'd be very curious for that report. Yeah, please. Thank you very much for this show.
Thank you.